Okay, well, I want to say hello again, some of you who, just a minute, let me turn on my wireless microphone. All the way to the left, David? Which way is left? Oh, I got it. How about that? Okay. I like wireless microphones so I can walk around. Keeps me alert while I'm teaching at Ambassador Bible Center. This morning, for some of you who weren't here, we did the first part of it, and we'll do a very fast review. When we say tribe trackers, we're tracking the tribes of Israel across the continents and through the centuries from where they were taken captive primarily by the Assyrians. Of course, some of the Jews were taken captive by Babylon, but they came back to Israel to a large extent. It's primarily the lost 10 tribes that we're focusing on. And this is all a part of being able to understand the backwash or the back channel of the identity of the United States and Britain in Bible prophecy. You also can identify a whole lot of other countries too. Oh, hold it. Turn that on too. All right, everything's on. The first item that we talked about this morning, after discussing this with you over lunch, some of you, I have to apologize for going so fast. Somebody said I couldn't get it all down. And I try to get some of it in your heads, a little bit of it down. But the first point is that the Bible is the superstructure of history. The world's historians don't understand history because they look at it from an evolutionary point of view. Or some other point of view, they don't value the Bible as a historical book. And yet, as far as ancient documents go, the Bible is the preeminent one. They try to write their ancient history from bits and snatches of a book here or a comment there. Normally, they can quote ancient historians because one historian was quoted by somebody else a few hundred years after he lived, who was quoted by somebody else a few hundred years after he lived. And so ancient history is bits and pieces put together. The Bible has ancient history laid out amazingly systematically. And obviously God is the author of history. We talked about Israelite history and some of the tribe tracks that you can find there. We talked about the self-evident prophecies, i.e., the prophecy that says the scepter will not depart from Judah, that from Judah, especially from the line of David, there would always be a king to rule over Israel until Shiloh comes, until Christ returns. We also talked about the prophecies of the United States and Britain coming from Ephraim and Manasseh, United States and Britain coming from Manasseh and Ephraim, the sons of Joseph. We talked about following the national names the tribes were known as they moved through history. Variations on the name for Hebrew or Eber, which was a great-great-grandfather of Abraham. King Omri, the seventh king of the northern 10 tribes of Israel. His name was the one the Assyrians called the country by. And then Isaac, and Isaac shall your seed be called. And the SK or SC, core consonants. Remember, ancient Hebrew did not have vowels written into it. All it was consonants. You know, when you stop and think about it, Hebrew is written from right to left, which is really foreign to our way of thinking. Starts in the upper right-hand corner and works its way down. In ancient Hebrew, there were no paragraphs. Don't you just hate it when you go and you read a book where the author liked to write in paragraphs or at least a page long? And you're like, oh, how am I ever going to get through that paragraph? Well, in Hebrew, there were no paragraphs. And furthermore, there was no punctuation, so you didn't even know when the sentences ended. And on top of that, there were no spaces between the words. It was hard to make paper. You know, what am I going to say? Don't waste it. No spaces between the words. They're all strung together. And on top of that, there weren't any vowels. Just consonants. And you're like, how did they read that? With some difficulty. But the point is, Where the words break was handed on by oral tradition. One generation taught another generation, and on down the line. Eventually somebody got the idea, well, maybe we should put vowel points in. And, you know, punctuation would be nice, but that was much later. So it was a challenge. Thus, you're looking for some key things. We looked for national names. We talked about archaeology, providing a lot of clues to tracking the tribes. One of the great ones was the Behistun rock inscription found on the ancient caravan trail between Baghdad and Tehran. And it showed how to translate ancient Assyrian. The Assyrians were profuse writers. And when Nineveh was discovered in the 1860s, it was the Rawlinson brothers, the same one we talked about this morning, found Nineveh. They began to bring up these cuneiform tablets. They had writing all over them. You know, they were very thorough people, were the Assyrians. Very systematic, very thorough. They wrote about everything in clay tablets, which got baked. You know, you couldn't send an email. You scratch in the clay tablet with a stylus, and you throw it in the oven, and they said, now take it. And so it was hot off the press, so to speak. Well, they survived, but they couldn't read them because they didn't know how to translate that language. It was on the Behistun Rock, a big cliffside, and very difficult to get to because once it was carved, King Darius, who was the emperor of the Medes and the Persians in the 500s B.C., he had the steps and the access to the carvings cut away. So that George Rawlinson did it. He did it by coming down over the mountain with ropes and then using ladders to go up and down to the various levels and made rubbings of everything. But it provided the translation key. Then you could read the cuneiform tablets and you could find out what the Israelites were doing and all the secret police work that the Assyrians were doing. So archaeology was important. Tribal and clan names. As the tribes moved through time, you look on maps to look for not only the tribal names, you look for the names of the clans. The clans would be the names of the sons of the tribal patriarchs and sometimes their grandsons. That's how those become clans. Okay, so that was a quick review of everything we did. Now we're ready to look at the blessing of the best places and things. Now, you'll be covering this, I presume, in some of the others to some degree because it's in our booklet pretty well covered. This was a blessing on Joseph. The God of your father will help you and by the Almighty who will bless you. This is Genesis 49, 25 and 26. It's the blessing to Joseph. The Almighty will bless you with the blessings of heaven above, the blessings of the deep that lies beneath, the blessings of the breasts and the womb. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. And they shall be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. Joseph received the birthright of the 12 sons of Jacob. Joseph got the birthright. The birthright meant that you got double whatever anybody else got. But it also carried a responsibility. It was because the son that got the birthright became then the clan's patriarch. And he had lots of responsibility. He had to look after his mother if his father outlived his mother outlived his father and oversee the clan itself. That then became Joseph's job while they were in Egypt. Now, blessings of heaven above. I read Stratfor as a STRATFOR, a news and analysis service that a friend of mine gets and copies me on interesting articles in it. One was the geopolitical analysis of the United States. We have probably the best country from a geographical perspective, based on the river systems alone. Phenomenal river systems, which enabled us early on, and even today, to transport the abundant food supplies we can produce, transport the food cheaply to where the people live. Lots of other countries have some good ground for growing things, but it's not close to where anybody lives, and they have a terrible time getting it there. Rivers are far better than rail systems. It's an amazing study what America has. But it was the blessings for Joseph. Look, consider some of the overview. The vast holdings of the British Empire. They ruled 25% of the world at their heyday. 25%. The sun literally didn't set on the British Empire. In 24 hours, the sun was on some part of the empire all the way around the world. And how did they do that? In England, during the late 1800s, they had about 20 million people. And they just told everybody what to do, and they said, okay, we'll do that then. It just didn't stand, doesn't come out as being reasonable, but they could just do that. It was a blessing from God. It certainly wasn't the brilliance of the British. The vast natural resources are not the brilliance of America either. It's a blessing from God. Now, one of the other prophecies you are aware of, the gates of their enemies, and that the tribes would control those, particularly the tribe of Joseph. Land and mountain passes. On land, you have gates. On mountain passes, Khyber Pass was controlled by the British for a very long time. There are different other locations. There are, in the sea, there are straits and strategic islands and harbors. And we aren't looking at a map, but you know some of them. Panama Canal was certainly one. The Cape at the bottom of Africa, just getting around there. Who wants to sail hundreds of miles further out into the ocean to get around Africa when you can just cut around the coast? And England controlled the coast when they obtained South Africa. The strategic islands, Guam is one. Hawaiian Islands, it's another set of islands that America has had. And various other locations, naval bases, those were strategic, especially at certain times, as well as harbors. So you have straits, strategic islands, and harbors. But the air and space gates are those that we haven't thought about. Maybe we haven't written about. America has strategically placed military bases all over the world. Most of them we don't even know about. We have satellites, which are our eyes in the sky, that have enabled us to dominate the world in these past few decades. We have power in the sky through missile systems that are more powerful than anybody else's. Of course, that some solace. I mean, we could blow things up faster than anybody else around. Well, pretty much, that's it. But that's the way of the world, isn't it? But America had those strategic strengths. They won't have it long. We know we are in the descendancy now of the tribes of Israel. Now, let's talk about tribes and legends. I think you'll find this interesting. The British school system used to teach this as history in the late 1800s and around the turn of the century into the 1900s. And part of that was with the tribe of Dan, that the Danites, an element of the tribe, not all the tribe, an element of the tribe sailed from Egypt to Greece about the time of the Exodus, when the rest of the Israelites, including the bulk of the tribe of Dan, were leaving by desert. Some of them had either left or already left by ship and sailed to southern Greece and over into Asia Minor. They became the Spartans and the Trojans. The Trojans and Spartans have historical traditions that they descended from the Danai. D-A-N-A-I is how they usually spell it. That then would certainly account for the tribe of Dan. You might say, well, the Israelites were slaves in Egypt. How could they possibly go sailing someplace if they were slaves in Egypt? Well, the answer is easy. Where did Israel live in Egypt? Where were they settled when Joseph came in? In the land of Goshen, which was in the Nile Delta, which means it was where the Nile fans out and dumps into the Mediterranean Sea, which would have been where the Egyptian harbors were. So they were up in that area. If Dan, therefore, got to be sailing, he wasn't just slaves making stone, making bricks. They would have been slaves on ships. You know, they get the good news and the bad news of the Danite rowers on the Pharaoh's yacht. They come out with double rations for lunch. That's the good news. And then they ask, what's the bad news? The bad news is Pharaoh wants to water ski in the afternoon. You know, so they're going to have to work harder. But the knowledge of sailing, they accumulated. So they colonized during the Black Sea during the period of Judges. For those of you here in the morning, you remember that we went through Judges chapter 5 where Deborah was scolding some of the tribes because they didn't come and help fight Sisera, the commander of the Canaanites. And Dan was one of the chicken-hearted ones. Or the, you know, it's not my war, leave me alone ones, maybe like that. Because she said, why does Dan remain in ships? Now that little comment gives an indication that Dan had ships. You don't read the other tribes having ships, except maybe Asher, because Asher remained in her inlets. Asher's inheritance was just below Tyre, right along the coast. So Dan was on the coast. You think, well, hold it. No, the city of Dan was up in the center. That was to prove another point. In the middle of the book of Judges, you hear the story of some of the Danites that got tired of living where they were, and they wanted to go and find a new place. So they marched into the center of the country and went right up the mountain chain through Ephraim, and stole somebody's pagan idol and his priest along the way. And they found this city called Laish up at the northern border of the Israelites. And they said, that's a pretty cool place. So they went back home, got reinforcements, came up, killed everybody, burned the city, and rebuilt Dan. They built their own city, and they called it after their grandpa Dan. Everything was named after Dan, apparently. They didn't have any other names to name anything with. Because they named Dan all over the place. And Dan would be D-N. The in English letters would be the D-N. So you could have Dun, Don, Dan, any variations thereof with the vowels. So they colonized the Black Sea. That, they were colonized about the time of the Judges, which is the 1200s B.C. And you have the rivers named all Dan, major rivers. Danube, Dnieper or Dniester, various variations of, and then the Don. You go up the Don a little ways, you have the Donay. If you go clear to the Baltic Sea, where the Scandinavia is, there's a river kind of flows north into the Baltic Sea called the Dana River. And then you've got Denmark right next to it. So Dan was everywhere up through there, and then landed over in Ireland. The Tuatha De Danann had long been in Ireland, and that means Tuatha De Danann is tribe of Dan. An element of the tribe of Dan was over there. Potentially having been put there by David or Solomon or one of the following kings as either a colony or a trade colony or maybe a mining colony. There was a lot of tin in the British Isles, and tin was used to make bronze with mixing it with copper. Now, this story here, Trojan descent of Brutus after defeat by the Greeks, left to found Rome and then London. Brutus was apparently a Trojan. Therefore, according to the traditions that were taught in British schools, was a Danite, and he left after the fall of Troy, and he went off, not by himself, he had people to go with him, and he established Rome, founded Rome as a city, long before Romulus and Remus and the she-wolf that raised them and their legends. This is a much more reasonable legend than the Romans' legend. And one of the evidences, potentially, because some of the tracks of the tribes, we might find, with lots and more research, oh, okay, well, that was a false lead. But when you see that it's a whole lot of tracks all going in the same general directions, and you find out, well, what I thought was an elk track was actually a horse that ran in behind the elk, then you mistook the horse track for a little while for another elk track. But when you see that all those tracks go that way, you know the herd went that way. Even if 70% of the tracks are sound. Next to Rome is the Tiber River. That's a variation of the word Heber, Eber. The Iber sound with a consonant stuck in front of it. Then he went around and found it, according to tradition, Londinium, as the Romans called it. They called it Londinium. Later it was just shortened to London. It would explain the Dan on the end of London if that was the case. Now, that's some of the tribe of Dan, some of the traditions, and you think, well, those are just traditions and legends. Well, traditions and legends have basis in fact. And it takes more research to look and find out, well, where's the actual fact? But traditions and legends aren't just made up out of blue sky, except things like these two boys were raised by a she-wolf and then they decided to be kings of Rome. The tribe of Asher. Odin was a priest king. Now, that's an interesting concept in Israelite history. priest kings would be most likely of what tribe? Which?
Levi.
Yes. And do we have any historical incidents of priest kings in Levi, of Levi, in any other part of Israelite history? Yes, we do. In the 100s BC, the Maccabee brothers. The Maccabean revolt against the Seleucids, who were the remnants of Alexander's empire that ruled over Palestine at the time, rebelled against them and cast them out. They had a big war against the Seleucids, the Greeks. And those Maccabees were Levite kings. They were priest kings. They weren't of the line of David, but they were kings of the kingdom of Judea at the time. So, Odin was a priest king who ruled the Aser, which can also be translated Asia men or Asia men or Asa or Asir. And numerous historians that write about them say that there is a tradition that they were the tribe or part of the tribe of Asher, or a tribal group that mostly was Asher and some others. They lived on Asgard, and there should be an A in the middle there, Asgard on the River Don. That's north of the Black Sea. And then Odin, and about the time of Christ, around the turn of the year zero, led his people to the Baltic Sea, north, a little bit northwest, and ruled Saxland. Saxland, if you come down off of Denmark today, you'll notice that it's up on the end of a little point, and you go further down on that neck of land, and you finally get down into the main body of Germany. Saxland was in there. And in Saxland is where the Saxons lived, by the way. The first wave of Saxons. He moved then into Scandinavia and he set up his shop, so to speak, on an island off the coast of what is now Sweden called Gothland or Gotland. Hence the Goths were named after Gothland. Later that was transferred to Sweden. One Israeli historian who believes in the identity of the tribes believes that, in fact, Gad was Switzerland, became Switzerland. We have in the past tagged Switzerland, or sorry, let me say this straight. Sweden is descended from Gad. In the past, in the church, we have thought that it was not Sweden, but Switzerland. The historian says, based on where he sees where the tribal or the clan names settled, he thinks that the bulk of the Swiss and the Finns are actually the two halves of Issachar, the strong donkey that's crouched down between two burdens. The Finns had the Slavs to one side and their brothers to the other side, the Vikings. And then the Swiss, according to his reasoning, had Assyria to the north of them and Rome to the south of them. But they were both tough characters, both halves of Issachar. I think his evidence bears consideration. We've never really banked on identifying some of the other tribes of Israel as being critical to end-time history. The critical part is knowing who Judah is and knowing who Ephraim and Manasseh are. You know, and that has become a key part of what we have looked at. Anyway, Odin led his people into Scandinavia, left his sons. He had two sons. He had many sons. Vegdeg and Beldeg, and I'll tell you some of his other sons in a minute, he left them to rule Saxland. Now, interestingly, in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is the ancient Anglo-Saxon history book, traces Anglo-Saxon genealogy to Woden, that's Odin, their way of saying Odin, they put a W in front of it, through his sons Wegdeg, which is the same thing as Vegdeg, because that W would sound like a V, more than likely, in the Germanic language, Vegdeg, and Beldeg, obviously just a variant spelling of Beldeg. So we have the corresponding traditions from two areas as far as Odin goes. There was one of Thor. Thor was one of the sons of Odin. If you've seen the movie Thor, Asgard was where they were supposed to be. It's this big city in the sky, and you know it's. What you say, well, that was all about Norse mythology. Yeah, where do you think mythology comes from? The gods of the world are men, originally, who have gone to legendary status and then become venerated in subsequent generations. Odin was in the first century BC, close to the year zero. By 400 years later, he's a god. And so is Thor, and so is his wife, Frey, from which we get Friday. Thor gives us Thursday, and Woden himself gives us Wednesday, Woden's Day. And a number of our days of the week are named after these people, because the days were named after pagan gods. Well, at the time that we gave names to days. Okay. Now, art history. This is another interesting aspect. I commented this morning that history has become sociology as far as most universities go. They don't really teach really in-depth history. They teach touchy-feely sociology type history, which could care less about things that happened in the past. They're much more of an activist of today, which means that you're going to have to really scramble in a history school to find any teachers that have any sense at all as far as history goes. My daughter majored in that at one of the more liberal universities in on the West Coast, University of Oregon. I think God blessed her. There happened to be a number of very conservative history professors, and she landed most of them at one time or another going through. The other thing she studied was art history. Art historians, and this was her experience, art history doesn't care about the sociology. They don't care about the warm fuzzies. They don't care about trying to change the history of the past by viewing it from the present. What they do is they want to know what happened, when did it happen, and what kind of art did they make in those days, so that they can track it. So art history is interesting. Here's some analysis of Scythian. Remember, Scythian is a variation right there. That's a very Scythian, if you will, a variation of Isaac. Are noted for their vigorous art style. The Scythians and the Celts were the same peoples. They're all a part of the 10 tribes, for the most part. Now, some of the people who got labeled Scythian later were not. They were Asiatic people who adopted the Scythian lifestyle. They were mounted archers, and then they had huge herds and flocks that they moved back and forth on the steppes of Russia for grazing. And when they weren't herding, they were shooting at each other. If they couldn't find somebody else to do it with. The Scythians are noted for their vigorous art style, which is one of the formative influences in the development of Celtic art in Europe. So, Scythian influenced Celtic art. Scythian burials, such as those under the mounds of Pazuric in Russia, are very elaborate and contain many artifacts decorated with fantastic animal motifs. That would be recent excavations, because there have been many Scythian excavations in Europe. In fact, you can't really tell Scythian from Celtic in Europe. In Germany, there were lots of burial mounds, and across the Hungarian plain to get into Russia. This is an example of Scythian art. Very, what do they say? Very vigorous art style. That's a vigorous art style. You got a battle here. These are Scythians. See that hat? It's a pointed hat, a floppy pointed hat. They're all wearing trousers, which was typical for all the centuries we have any kind of evidence of the Scythians. They wore trousers. They didn't wear kilts. The Celts wore kilts. Except for the Celt berserkers. The Celtic berserkers were warriors that fought naked. And they were terrifying to the Romans, because they could, one man with a two-handed sword, no shield, he could go in like a Jedi Knight and slice up a whole platoon of Roman soldiers. And the only way the Romans overcame those is because the Celts couldn't stay in the field long enough. They were part-time soldiers. They had crops to grow. And the Romans had a professional army. And they were more organized, because if the Celts didn't fight with the Romans, they fought with each other. So, you know, it gave them an advantage. But they called them berserkers. They were crazy. Crazy men. And the only thing that a group of Roman soldiers hated to fight more than a berserker, a Celtic berserker, was a Celt or a Gaul. Gaul and Celt are interchangeable terms. A Gallic man and his wife, because she carried the same kind of sword, and she was strong, and she fought naked too, which was distracting, I guess. And They painted tattoos all over them. It's really kind of odd, but the berserkers were the front line. Later, they had to learn to be more systematic. They terrified the Romans until Julius Caesar got more organized and overwhelmed them. But this is a vigorous style. Horses, swords, shields going on, dead horse down there, and that's a comb. And now these little things here are lions. And they're all scrunched down so you know that they're all lions. I think, anyway. Alright, the timing of Scythian art coincides with the Syrian invasions in the early 700s into Syria, and Syria then is Syria today, Phoenicia, and the northern Israelites. Now, let me explain Phoenicia. The Greeks, that's a Greek word. They pronounce it Pun, Phoenicia. That meant everybody that lived in Lebanon, that was where Tyre and Sidon were, and everybody all the way down. The Greeks were not generally, apparently, really specific geographically, so they would just label a bunch of people something or another. And so the Israelites and the Phoenicians are exactly the same in the Greeks' eyes. They were Phoenicians. So when you talk about Phoenician art, you're also talking about Israelite art, for the most part. It was called sometimes Neo-Assyrian art. The reason is that the Assyrians took them captive at that time in the 700s BC, and they heavily influenced Assyrian artistic styles. Thus, Neo-Assyrian, also called Phoenician art, remarkably similar to Celtic art. So here is a Celtic warriors in a chariot. They describe, just an indicates a little bit of it, but I'm going to go through some of the characteristics of Scythian and Celtic art. Both of them use zoomorphic structure. That is, that means an animal picture where an animal morphs into something else. They kind of connect, the animals do. Inversion. They bend the rear part of the body of the animals quite often in the way they do their art. Animal arrangement in the form of a cross or a swirl. We'll see the swirl in particular. A recumbent posture, like the horse that was on his back on the top of that comb. Lotus and palmette motifs. They like to do lions, fallow deer, roosters, raptors, obviously horses, because they were a horse culture. And then fabulous composite creatures called griffins. And the griffins could be part leopard and part unicorn and part horse and part bull. They would be all kinds of weird things, and sometimes with wings, sometimes with a beak instead of with teeth. They called those griffins. Now, this is a Hallstatt Celtic torque, an ancient Celtic torque. Those are little horses right there, a little bit hard to see with the ambient light. This is a Scythian torque, again, a very similar style, and you've got your animals. You've got looks like a lion on each end of the torque. They like to wear torques. The Celts use the eagles as well as the Scythians. This is a Celtic helmet with an eagle on top. This is a Scythian plaque, probably a buckle. That was it. Now, this is a more indicative of some of the zoomorphic structure. This is Scythian here. It's a lion-y kind of creature, a little bit odd. And you notice there are all these funny markings down through the feet and the whole tail. And when you get up really close, you find out that each of those feet and all those junctures in the tail is that thing. It's an imitation of the overall very piece of intricate gold work. But classic example of the Scythian zoomorphic structure. Animal connected to animal connected to animal, and using, you know, little animals to help illustrate a big animal. Over on the left, we have an illustration out of the Book of the Kells. This was the first, or the oldest, maybe it's the oldest, Celtic book that is still in print, still available. They have the original, or originals. And this is simply an illustration. It was actually a Latin translation of the four Gospels, but it was illustrated in the Celtic style. This is a T, but you notice that that's a cat. And what do you know? If you start looking, well, there's another cat up there. And you come down, and there are two more eyes. There's a cat right there. And there's one right there. And if you had a clearer picture and a magnifying glass, you'll find four more small ones just there. But again, the style is very similar to this. you know, they have the swirling animal figurine, the zoomorphic juncture of one animal into another, and that was pretty classic of both Celtic and Scythian art. Now, the reason that we want to connect them is because they were the same peoples. They were still all a part of this, of the 12 tribes. So when we read in history about the Scythians and the Celts, then we know, okay, there's a connection between those people, and the bulk of them would have been descended from some of the tribes of Israel. Linguistics is another very interesting element of tracking the tribes. British historian Sharon Turner, that's a guy, probably Jewish, because that's like Ariel Sharon, that's how they say Sharon. It was a guy name in Israel more than a girl name. 1827, he did the preeminent study that got English labeled as an Indo-European language. And the reason for that is the part of the Armenia having been named Sakasina, as mentioned by Strabo in another place, and seems to give a geographical locality to our primeval ancestors and to account for the Persian words that occur in the Saxon language, as they must have come into Armenia from the northern regions of Persia. Now, he did the study in 1827 of the root words of Persian, ancient Persian, which would have been the Parthian language before them, and we'll get to Parthian shortly. And then he compared it to English, and he could see the connection. Thus, English is drawn from the Indo-European fountain of languages back down in that area of the world. More recently, that was 1827, this is 1981. Linguistic historian Professor Terry Blodgett, Southern Utah University, phonological similarities in Germanic and Hebrew was his thesis. His findings of his research, fully one-third of the underlying structure of the Germanic languages, that's English and German, Scandinavian for the most part, and some of the others in Europe, one-third of the underlying structure of Germanic language is derived from Hebrew, thus the connection. Now, you've heard of Gaelic language or the Celtic language. Irish can speak Gaelic to a certain degree. The Welsh can and the Scots, some can. Irish in particular, the Gaelic, the Welsh is the most obvious. When you speak Welsh Gaelic and you say a sentence and then you say the same sentence in Hebrew, they are the same sentence. They're the same words. It's just two different dialects of the same language, word for word. Quite amazing. And in similarity is the same pretty much with Scottish Gaelic and Manx and Irish. So the connection with Hebrew to English is very strong. Now, let me give you an example here. We say bashful or abash, and in Hebrew the word is bash. You say both A's in a word like that. We say rabble. You know, they're just a bunch of rabble. They say rob. Was their version of rabble. Okay, well, that doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that those words are connected. We say cipher, except we don't do that. We just do math now. But it used to be, if you're very old, you remember when you had to cipher things. Add it all up. The Hebrew word was safar. Put an emphasis on a different syllable, but it's basically the same. You scrape your hand, and you have a sore. If you're an Israeli, you have a tzur. The word is the same. If you're cold, you shiver. If you're cold in Israel or in ancient Hebrew, you shaver. The V and the B are phonetically interchangeable because of the way it's hard to tell when you're saying a V sound or a B sound. If you get sick and you throw up, or in the vernacular, you puke, which didn't used to be a, you know, gross word. It just was meant you threw up. If you're in Hebrew, you pook. How close? If you cooked your steaks too long and you char them, you would do the same thing in Hebrew. It would be chara, which is the way I like my steaks cooked. If you're not smart, that's not it. If you can't hear or can't speak in English, you're dumb. If you're dumb in Hebrew, you're dom or dom. Very similar words. And this is just a sampling. Earth in English is aretz in Hebrew. E-R-E-T-Z. Aretz is their variation of earth. This was just a sampling I pulled out of his Terry Blodgett's research to give you an idea. But the point is, Hebrew and English are very similar, especially with the root words. So we have this phonological, meaning this language connection of the tribes, the descendants in England and America, with the ancient Israelites. And likewise, because he was studying Germanic languages, which includes more than English, there is a strong, strong linguistic connection. Historical atlases. We have to thank a Roman map maker or geographer named Claudius Ptolemaeus of Alexandria in Egypt. We just know him as Ptolemy in the shortened version of his name. Now, why he's called Ptolemy when in fact his name was Ptolemaeus, I'm not sure. But it does show you that he's known like this and he's known like that. And you can see, obviously, that Ptolemy is in Ptolemaeus. And that from Ptolemaeus, you can get the Ptolemy. Go figure. But it shows how names change slightly as they move between languages or down through time. Second century AD, he was a geographer. He believed in a round earth. He wrote a book. Well, actually, it was 8 volumes. It was called Geography. And probably we get to use the word because he used it. He had access at that time in the second century AD to sources that were hundreds of years older than when he lived, going back into BC 200 or 300 years or more. Thus, he's one of the earliest of our map makers. There are a few others, but Ptolemaeus did the preeminent work of the geography of the world. Now, based on those maps of Ptolemaeus, we now get to look at the map collection that I had drawn up for this study. This is in 720 BC. That was when Samaria fell. 720 BC is when Samaria fell. Samaria was the capital city of the northern 10 tribes. And 721 or 720 is when the Assyrians destroyed Samaria and hauled all the Israelites away into their areas of the Samaria or of the Assyrian Empire, out to the borderlands there and up into the north central part of it there. In 650 BC, from 720 to 650, 130 years or something, the Assyrian Empire is not doing well. It's starting to wane. The Scythians and the Sumerians have gotten strong. Remember, the Sumerians are a name that derives from King Omri. And let me see where we got them. Right here. They're in Asia Minor, and they actually will cross the Bosphorus in the next few decades and move into Europe and link up with the Celts who were already there. The Celts had already had a population in Britain, in Ireland, in Gaul, or France, long before even the Assyrian Empire took over the 10 tribes, as either trade colonies or other mining colonies of David and Solomon. The Scythians have begun to break loose and move away from the Assyrians. They over here are called the Saka. Between the Caspian and the Black Sea, they're called Scythians, and they will move on over into Europe. The Saka will mill around over here in this area for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Some of them will get tired of it and go to China and try to import things from China really cheap. And the Chinese will get ticked off and build a wall. That's what happened. So, there we go. They were taken here, and then as they grew in power within the empire, they got drafted into the army as the decades went by. They rose through the ranks. They actually, according to some traditions, the Scythian leaders actually dominated the leadership of the empire for 28 years, getting close to the end of its time. The Assyrian Empire began to fall in 614, 650, and then 614, they were conquered. Nineveh was conquered, their capital city. In 605, they were finished off by Nebuchadnezzar. Scythian archery was a part of their power base. They could ride horses and shoot short, powerful bows. There's an archer there with a short, powerful bow. They're killing a lion. Again, example of their style of art. The Scythian bow was a double recurved affair, highly complex composite bow, had a core of wood, it had sinew on the back, it had horn on the belly, and then it was normally wrapped in another layer of leather to keep it from the elements. They were very powerful bows. Herodotus in 450 BC, so, you know, sometime 200 years later, Herodotus, the Greek historian, considered to be the first historian, but he really wasn't. Moses probably was. Herodotus went to visit the Scythians, and what he wrote in his histories is that in order to be a warrior in the Scythian army, you had to be able to shoot 3 arrows at 60 bow lengths. And when you look at that length there, his bow is the length of his horse's neck. It's around 40 inches, right up to the top of his ears, if that's a typical one, and it appears to be. Those kind of bows could be short, and that makes them handy on horses. But still, that's at least a meter in length. 39 inches is a meter, roughly 39 inches. So 60 meters, the arrow had to be shot, and every arrow of those 3 arrows had to hit the target that we were shooting at, and the 3rd arrow had to be in the air before the 1st arrow struck the target. Now, if you've done archery when you were in school, or you bow hunt like I do, you know that that's really hard. You got to be fingering and yanking, and the bows were phenomenal. Based on some research, these bows may have been upwards of 150, 160 pounds pull. And you think, well, how could they, anybody do that? Ask the English. The war bows, the English longbow. The war bows, we know what they were because in Elizabeth, the first day, they launched a beautiful battleship called the Mary Rose, which sailed into the harbor of Liverpool. The Queen was there watching it go, and it was the best thing that England had ever had and beat everybody else, except for one minor detail. It was a bad design, top-heavy, and it had cannon and everything, and probably too many of them. It tipped over and sank right in the harbor. In the 1980s, they found it, and they brought it up and, you know, made it into a museum. In the armory, they found 40 longbows made out of yew wood. They dried them all out very carefully, measured them all out, and made exact replicas, the royal bowyers did, so they could see what they were capable of. They were, their weakest one was a 90-pound pull. The strongest was 160 pounds. I used to go shooting in Oregon with occasionally with a man who held the world record for a long time. He could pull a 175-pound bow. But there was a Cherokee chief in 1990, Chief AJ, pulled a 200-pounder. You know, again, a longbow. So the Scythians pulling 150-pound bows on horseback, the English did it, the Scythians could do it too. It took a lot of conditioning, but they were forced to be met with. Now, 300 BC, we've moved down the line. Alexander is on the scene. He's actually conquered some of the Scythians. Also, his forces have begun to push the Saka, elements of the Saka, more up into the Tarim Basin on their way toward China. Scythians have moved further north here. Cimmerians are into Europe. The Gauls are a significant force over here and periodically are threatening Rome. The Celts also exist up in there. What we should have added is a Celtic presence in Europe, in Spain as well, on our map and will in a future one. Here we have in Gaul, you can see all these names of different groupings and such, of the tribe or the tribal or clan groupings that were there. And it's those kinds of maps. Some of this is what Herodotus produced, and so they study the ancient maps and overlay them as best they can onto modern maps so we can see what they were. And you can see where which people lived during which time in history. Historical atlases are fun things to page through when you've got lots of other stuff to do. They're still fun. In England, it was the same way. You had different groupings of people. Some of them moved back and forth. The Parisi, for example, didn't stay there. They went back to France before all was said and done. But these were groupings of the Celts and the names that they were known by. Some of those were clan names from some of the other tribes. Now, down to 150 BC, we have some new forces taking place. Alexander had pushed a lot of Saka up into the Chinese area. We have the rise of the Parthian Empire there. Most have not heard of the Parthian Empire. Most history books don't write about the Parthian Empire. It controlled the area of Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, to a large extent, clear to the Indus River in India periodically. It expanded and contracted to a certain degree. Romans always tried to conquer it and couldn't do it. It lasted for about 500 years. The beginnings of it were 250 BC, and it came to its end with a revolt of the Sassanian Persians in 226 AD. Because they ruled. They ruled the people we know as the Persians. They ruled everybody else that was around in there. Now, where do they get the name Parthian? Well, you got the PRT. The IAN is just an addition, just a suffix. The PRT is basically the same as BRT in Britain. The British-ish is the Hebrew for man. Brit, B-R-T, no consonants, just Brit, is covenant. Covenant man is what British means. PRT, the B's and P's are, again, phonetically interchangeable. It can be very easily taken, therefore, as covenant people. Based on the Aaron names of places down in there, one of the grandsons of Ephraim, it would appear that the Ephraimites were heavily a part of the Parthian Empire at one time. Very powerful, sat on the Silk Road, and therefore made lots of money. 150 BC, they're starting to get some power. Rome is beginning to build. Gaul has not been conquered yet by Julius Caesar. The Gutons are already beginning to be known in Scandinavia. Roxolani, the Alans, are beginning to show up there. The Parthians, to talk a little bit more about them, they have Scythian origins. This is what the researchers have had, the historians have shown. They rose to power with the aid of a Scythian super-tribal group called the Massagete. We would see that as Manasseh and Gad, Massagete. Arch-rival to Rome, mounted archers. There's an example of a Parthian archer. Defeated the Roman general Crassus in 53 BC. They wiped out his entire legion of men, about 6,000 men. He wiped them all out, with the exception of a tiny few that managed to run for their lives. And their empire lasted from 250 BC to 226 AD. This is the one thing we have in English that reminds us of the Parthians. The Parthian shot. That was the Parthian shot. They were horse archers. They would charge at the Romans. The Romans were disciplined infantry. They throw up their shield wall. Their arrows were useless to shoot through the shields. So they would charge right into javelin throwing distance and mill around like they were in confusion. And then, of course, then the officers of the Romans would say, drop shields and charge. They would drop their shields and they would charge forward and get their javelins to throw. And as soon as the shield wall went down, the Parthians were waiting. They weren't milling about in confusion. They were just mocking the enemy. They started firing the shots over the back of their horses as they rode out of distance, as fast as they could fire them into the soldiers. And they shot powerful enough bows, they'd go through the breastplates and kill. So that was how they managed to defeat the Romans. Phenomenal archery power. By AD 150, now we're 150 years after the time of Christ, and the Roman Empire is at its biggest influence, or basically so. Parthia still exists. The Alans are up in here. Bear in mind, you'll have some Israelites scattered amongst the Romans in Spain and in Gaul. Celts here, Rome ruled Britain at that time. The Goths were beginning to be known in this part of Europe. We have the Roxolani, the Sakha, moving in from Asia there. The Teutons, I missed one. Let me see. Sakha, we have some of them beginning to come back from Europe. The Massagete were called by the Chinese Yu Qi. So when you read the Chinese histories of the Yu Qi that they fought against all the time, that was the way they said Gete. They couldn't get the G sound or the T sound to come out, so it came out Yu Qi, Gu Qi. And they're trying to say Gete or Gete. We sometimes sound like that ourselves. AD 300, Persian Empire now exists, Parthia is gone, and the Parthians disappeared. The historians say they just disappeared. They disappeared, but then the population of Armenia swelled a decades afterwards as the migrations began to go out. We have Alans that are in here, Ostrogoths here, That means Eastern Goths, Visigoths, or the Western Goths, Teutons, and Guthans up there in Scandinavia. The Gauls are still here and still ruled by Rome. 500, things have changed. Rome fell several times by the barbarians. So let's talk about the barbarians. These are the arrows of the barbarians. The Alans and the Vandals came sweeping through, trying to find a place to settle, and if anybody didn't like them, then they would have a big fight, and then they'd move on. They recoiled from a couple of defeats, but they were quite powerful, tried to settle in France. The Franks didn't like them there. The Franks were from Reuben. So then they had to move on. They landed in Spain. In Spain, they found some places they could be, and they also conquered the ports down here. Suddenly, they had ships. And so the story goes, ah, cool. We can leave this continent and go to that continent. So they crossed over and rebuilt Carthage, took over. This was all a Roman province in here. This was the breadbasket of Rome, in fact. They just took it over. Booted the Romans out. Well, the Romans left because they were terrified of the Vandals coming through. They were powerful fighters. Then they fought with Rome for a while. They had a powerful empire for 80 years. And then they begin to lose their grip on the power. Rome began to regroup and to be able to attack more effectively back. So they left again. They knew how to sail, and they just sailed away up and around into this area up in here and settled. The blue are the Visigoths bouncing down through here, conquering Rome. Rome got conquered a lot of times. They say the barbarians sacked Rome. Typically, they didn't destroy the city. They might extract a payment, you know, pay me this much gold, and I need about 5 tons of gold and 10 tons of silver, and then we'll leave. But they didn't destroy Rome like they're always said. The Romans were the destroyers. The barbarians typically didn't, not even the Huns. When Attila marched on Rome, he didn't even destroy it, and Attila destroyed about everything else that he came close to. The Ostrogoths came down, and they hit Rome as well. Then we have in 500 A.D., this is all happening up here, the Jutes. Remember, Denmark had another name. Remember the Battle of Jutland, where the British Navy crossed the T on the German Navy. And as they crossed the T, they could bring all their side-firing battleship guns to bear, and they destroyed the Kaiser's Navy. On the Battle of Jutland, it was off the coast of Denmark. That was the name of Denmark before, it was Jutland, name for the Jutes. The Jutes came down in here, the Saxons and Angles moved over, and they started fighting with the Celts. Pushed the Celts eventually back mostly into Scotland and Wales and over back over to Ireland. And that brings us then up to 500 A.D. What we haven't tracked is the Davidic line that led to the rise of the royal families of Europe, primarily of England. That's all another story. You can only cover so many tribe tracks at a time. Tribal and national traits. You get national traits sometimes from the meanings of their name. Joseph would be one for sure. He will add. And Zebulun, dwelling, a haven for ships. The biggest harbor in the world. I think it still is, but it has been up until, if it's a change, it's only been very recently, it was Rotterdam. The biggest harbor, a haven for ships. The Dutch were famous shippers as well. Now, cultural traits. Let's take Manasseh. Remember, when Manasseh was named by his father Joseph, he had his first child in Egypt. He had a wife, and then he had a child, and suddenly he had a family. And he says, now I can forget that I have lost my family because they booted me all out, sold me into slavery, treated me badly. I have a family now. So Manasseh helped him forget that. So Manasseh means to forget or forgetful. Now, what would the cultural implications be of a people who can forget things? You can say, well, some of it's good and some of it's bad. For instance, they can forget their differences quickly, which leads to a sense of fair play. Manasseh has done that. Look at World War II. We're at the heyday of, nearing the heyday of Manasseh's influence. They vanquish the Japanese. They vanquish the Germans. And what do? Destroy them? Enslave them? No. They pump billions of dollars back into their countries to rebuild them. They rewrite their constitutions to help them, you know, be more like America was. And they made allies out of them for 60-some, almost 70 years now. But they could forget from one war's over, okay, how can we help? Most nations don't do that. What if the war had ended the other way around? You hate to think about it. But there is something good about that. Now, the bad news is, if your name is forgetful, what else are you going to forget eventually? God's law. That's right. You're going to forget God's law. And Hosea said that in Hosea 4 and verse 6. My people have forgotten me and forgotten my law. Isaac means laughter. Again, a sense of fair play. But let's take it to another step forward. If you have a sense of fair play, because you can laugh at yourself, you don't take yourself too seriously like emperors and dictators do, then you believe in the rule of law. Even the leaders are ruled by the law. And America talks about the rule of law. The conservatives talk about it all the time because the liberal movement is eroding it badly in America over these past decades. But the rule of law has been the strength of this country to a large extent. Now, the root for Manasseh comes from Noshe, which means movement from its proper place. Remember when Jacob was wrestling with the angel, who was actually Jesus Christ before his human birth that night, and they wrestled all night, and then God reached out and pushed his joint out of place. The movement from its place. It was applied Noshe to it. And then Jacob limped, but he wouldn't let go, because he prevailed with God. So he got the blessing. One of the words in Hebrew for women is noshim, which is based on noshe, movement from its proper place. A woman had her own identity before she married. Then she was moved from her own identity to the identity of her husband. She gave him, in that sense, her identity. They two shall be one flesh. And you think, well, that's bad. No, that's good. That's the way it's meant to be. But that doesn't put the woman at a weakness based on the thinking of the Bible or Jewish thinking for that matter. That meant that she makes her husband responsible to her. I give you my identity to take on your name, but in return, I'm extending you this credit of my identity. In return, I expect you to treat it responsibly, to represent me responsibly. You know, he who does not provide for his own, especially those of his own household, is an infidel. 1 Timothy 5:8, the biblical principle. So the wife expects to be responsibly represented by her husband because he has been delegated as her representative as well as his in the families. Delegated representation has become the governmental form of the United States. So it's another interesting track as you look at the way the words have been used. Tribe tracking in the New Testament, we'll try to get some of the highlights. The 12 tribes of Israel, Matthew 19:28, for your reference. Once again, I wrote 3 vertical thought articles that cover the key elements of this. I don't know if I covered art history or not. They were in Vertical Thought several years ago, and you can go to verticalthought.org, put in tribe trackers and my name, and they'll pop up, and you can print them and then use those as a reminder of some of this seminar. The 12 apostles will each rule one of the 12 tribes of Israel. When Stephen was giving his stir to action, to beat all stir to action speeches in Acts chapter 7, how do I have 26? I think it's actually supposed to be 7 in verse 26. To this promise our 12 tribes, earnestly serving God night and day, hope to attain. So Stephen referred to the 12 tribes. James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. Not just the two tribes of Benjamin and Judah, but the 12 tribes, the other 10 as well, are mentioned specifically in the New Testament. They didn't just disappear. The apostles knew where they were. The New Covenant chapter in Jeremiah 31 talks about Rachel weeping for her children. I don't know if you remember when that was read, but do you remember, it was 9-11, what was it, Tuesday, so 9-12 was Wednesday, 9-13, it was 9-14-01. It was that Friday after 9-11. The 9-11 attacks took place on a Tuesday. that Friday, we had a service in the National Cathedral. I didn't even know we had one, but we did. And one of the ministers, there were a lot of ministers invited, one of them chose to read. A voice was heard in Ramah, which is a city north of Jerusalem. Lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted for her children because they are no more. And he quoted that. I thought it was amazing. Rachel is the mother of Joseph and Benjamin. There is hope in your future, says the Lord, that your children shall come back to their border. So tribe tracking is involved in the New Covenant chapter. Granted, it's not the New Testament, but it connects to the New Testament because of the New Covenant. Why track the tribes? Paul said of the tribes, in Romans 9, 10, and 11 are three chapters where Paul dealt with the issue of the tribes of Israel extensively. Who are the Israelites? To whom pertain the adoption as the sons of God, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the service of God, and the promises, of whom are the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, from whom, according to the flesh, Christ came, who is over all eternally blessed God. Amen. So, the study of the tribes is sanctioned in the New Testament. To have some inkling of where they are, how they got there, is part of the study. Paul's countrymen. This is chapter 9 again. I tell the truth in Christ, I'm not lying, my conscience also bearing me witness in the Holy Spirit, that I have great sorrow and continual grief in my heart, for I could wish that I myself were accursed from Christ for my brethren, my countrymen, according to the flesh. Paul's not just talking about the Jews. He's talking about Israel. That's what the chapter 9, 10, and 11 are about. Chapter 10, my heart's desire and prayer to God is for Israel, that they may be saved. For there is no distinction between Jew or Gentile. God offers salvation to all nations. Israel was supposed to have been an example, a good example. They weren't often, but he still prays for them. Romans 11, verse 1. Has God cast away his people? Has he cast away the 10 tribes? Has God rejected them? Certainly not. For I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. Tribe tracking is a mystery. I do not desire, again Romans 11, verse 25 this time, I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness has in part happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved. The opportunity will be given. Now they have to make the choice, but the opportunity will be given to all of Israel eventually. And that's a mystery. Part of the mystery is knowing how God has moved the tribes down through time. And finding that, you know, if we know what we're looking for, you can actually track them. And all those prophecies that we used to read in the United States and Britain Prophecy Booklet that made a prophecy in the ancient past that landed into modern times, in our time today, the past couple hundred years, and you look for the fulfillment to make the connection, and that was how Mr. Armstrong reasoned and established the connection. You can also follow through the centuries. They're available to find historically. They didn't disappear. You just have to know what you're looking for. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is Romans 11 again. Speaking to the Gentiles about Israelites. Concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. But concerning the election, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. God loves Israel, loves all tribes and nations, but he loves Israel. Into the future. This is Jeremiah 16. Why has the Lord pronounced all this great disaster against us? Or what is our sin that we have committed against the Lord our God? The answer came, because your fathers have forsaken me, and you have done worse than your fathers, and I will cast you out of this land. That's why they were lost. God cast them out of the land. First the northern Israelites, and then the Jews later. God will restore them, though, looking forward in verse 14 and 15 of Jeremiah 16. The Lord lives, the underlined part, who brought the children of Israel from the land of the north and from all the lands where he had driven them. He'll bring them back. And he will actually send trackers to look for them. At the end of this age, when Christ has returned and the second Exodus is ready to go, God's going to go look because they have been enslaved. They have been taken captive. The destruction is on a scale that is just will stagger our imagination when we see it happen. The prophecy of thirds in Ezekiel 5. One third will die by famine. One third will die by pestilence, which goes with famine. And then a third will suffer the sword. And only a few will escape, and I'll take a sword out after them too. Amos gives us the statistic, the sobering statistic. The town of 100 will come back 10. The city of 1,000 will come back 100. That potentially all that will be left is 10% of the Israelites, you know, modern nations. Now, presumably those who are non-Israelite that live in the modern nations may be lumped into that. It's hard to say. Maybe that's the final statistic for all of mankind after the Great Tribulation and the Day of the Lord. But whatever the case, when it's time to go round up the Israelites to bring them back to the Promised Land, where they initially will be resettled before they have to recolonize, that shouldn't take more than a generation and a half, I will send many hunters, and they shall hunt them from every mountain and every hill and out of the holes of the rocks. For my eyes are in all their ways, and they're not hidden from my place, nor is their iniquity hidden from my eyes. God's going to bring them back. He's going to go send out the trackers to find them, and the fishermen to fish for them. And then they'll be coming back in the second Exodus. The conclusion, tribe tracking finds faith. We're tracking the tribes of Israel. We know that we're on the trail of the foundation of prophecies. Jesus was born of Israel to the tribe of Judah. That was prophesied. It had to be fulfilled for him to be the Messiah. He was of the tribe of Judah. We know who the tribe of Judah was because we know something about the whole nation of Israel, all the 12 tribes, so to be able to identify the specifically the tribe of Judah. Tribe tracking, therefore, clarifies end-time prophecy. Who are the major players? Tribe of Joseph has been provided some of the major players. And it clarifies the time of Christ's second coming. God, if God works in history, He can work in your life and my life too. And God can work in history, and you're just seeing a little tidbit of that. So, again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and present this seminar. And I'm glad the Millers invited us to come up for this. And as I said, it's part the end for now. We continue to do more research and add things to it, other elements of the Tribe Tracker's Guide to History. But it does provide us with a keen insight into how God has been working in world events. Even now, He is working. So, again, thank you, and we'll look forward to visiting with you afterwards.